So this past week, Mike, I downloaded an app that I should have downloaded a very long time ago. Can you guess what it is?
What's that?
Keyboard Maestro.
You just downloaded Keyboard Maestro?
For the very first time, Joe Bulig has downloaded Keyboard Maestro.
My mind is blown. This is, if Joe Bulig existed as an application, it would probably be Keyboard Maestro.
It's very true. You are not wrong. I put this out on Twitter and there was a couple of folks that emailed me and texted me. It's like, what is wrong with you, dude? Don't know. Just never really did it. And here we are.
So what do you think?
I think I have a big learning curve yet.
Yeah, you do.
Because there's some stuff that it does that I know that there's some stuff I would love for it to do, but I haven't spent the time just to play with it and build some stuff in it. At the same time, I know that a very large part of why I haven't gotten into Keyboard Maestro in the past is primarily because I do tons of scripting that run automatically, scripts that run automatically already, and do it the hard way instead of using like a GUI like Keyboard Maestro. So there's never really been a need I've felt. And then I don't remember what it was. I ran across somebody talking about plugins and stuff for it. It's like, you know what? If I could build plugins for that and have stuff run automatically, that may save me a lot of time. So then I promptly went to the Keyboard Maestro website, purchased and downloaded the thing. And now I've got a big thing to play with, a new toy to play with. So here we are.
Nice.
I have no idea what that has to do with our book for today, but it was fun.
There's a plugin, I believe, for the Stream Deck, which allows you to trigger Keyboard Maestro macros from your Stream Deck. I assume you have a Stream Deck, seeing as
yes.
You stream things.
Correct. I have one of the 32-key, like the big ones, XLs.
Yeah. I just have the 15 and had trouble filling it up for a while, but now I'm starting to get to the point where I want to create different profiles and things like that. I don't think I want a bigger one sitting on my desk, but since you got all those buttons, if you're looking for things to do with them, map your Keyboard Maestro macros to them.
Yeah, I figured that out very quickly. And I will say, like, the whole profiles thing on the Stream Deck, like, for example, Mike, you would appreciate this. If you set one up for Obsidian, a whole bunch of stuff that's normally kind of complicated gets super easy.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can chain things together and tell it to pull up, like, the command palette and then start typing stuff and do stuff automatically. And it's very, very simple. So I love it. You should get in. It's a very deep hole that you'll spend way too many hours in.
You know what I really want is like a Chromebook that runs Obsidian OS. It's the only application that opens. You can install the plugins, things like that, but you can't leave Obsidian. I feel like that would be pretty great.
You're familiar with MDM, Mobile Device Management?
Mm-hmm.
If you bought an iPad for that purpose, set up MDM on it, you can lock it to a specific app so that the only thing it can do is run that one app.
Yeah, see, that's more money than I want to spend, though. I'm thinking,
you're the one that brought up this ridiculous idea. So.
Yeah, I don't want an iPad. I literally want a Chromebook, just like Chromebooks are for getting on the web. I want that thing for Obsidian and nothing else.
So then you would have a separate computer just for Obsidian at all times, and that's all you would use Obsidian with?
No, that would be the thing, like the 8-inch clamshell. You grab it, throw it in your bag, take it with you wherever. Kids beat on it as they bring it back and forth to school in their backpacks, sort of a thing. But you got your full keyboard and all that jazz.
What's the top-end dollar amount you're willing to spend on this thing?
Good question. I don't know. I just think that would be really cool.
I was going to say, because if it's like $200-$300, like that's some of the lower-end refurbed iPads and stuff. So
yeah, I don't want an iPad though.
Just saying.
I don't like the keyboards that are available with the iPads. I don't want to put it in a bridge case. I don't want one of the stupid smart folio things. Like I don't know. I'm just thinking like the Chromebook is like a specialized little laptop. It'd be cool to have a specialized little laptop just for Obsidian.
Martin has a good tip for you in the chat. Get a cheap Lenovo laptop, put Linux on it, and remove everything except Obsidian.
I may have to try that. Except I know nothing about Linux. So
you're familiar with Mac. You'll be fine.
But I'll have to try that. I mean, I'll have to convince Joe Bulig to try that for me.
Tis not hard. I just set up a new Linux thing 2 days ago. Super fun. Anyway.
See, you should write about this and publish it.
About how to do it? That's what I follow the how-tos. I don't
know. No, you should create this thing and then publish it.
Oh, like how to have a single, like a laptop that's just Obsidian. Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
You know, now that you say that, I've got a couple of laptops I could do that with.
See? See, you're the guy for this.
Why do you do this to me? Why? This is...
I'm just an idea guy. I'm just talking.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm going to charge you for this one. All right, we should do some follow-up because you've got a bunch here and I've got a few. And... we should get through it. Do you want to start?
I was hoping we weren't going to get to this. No, just kidding. Yeah. I feel like a couple weeks ago when we were going to record, I was in a much better place with these follow-up items. And now, 2 weeks later, I have no idea what I did with these. I know I did something. No, I'll tackle these one by one. Some of them are more sticky than others. So list out what I fear in a single sentence. I don't remember if I did this or not, so I'm assuming I did not. Asking the question, how was I curious today? I did add this to my daily note, and I've filled it out a couple times. So that's been successful in my book. Make a list of people who inspire me and start asking questions. I've done this. I think there's probably more questions to be asked here, but having the list is the starting place. Share encouraging text messages more frequently. I think I've done this twice. It's gone really well. It's awesome. I want to do it more, but I just never think about it. So this is a good reminder for me to try to do that more often. And then find a meditation practice that works for me. I think we're going to talk about meditation and mindfulness in today's book. And there's some takeaways from this book that reframe it a little bit differently for me. I've always viewed meditation, and I know you can do it without the app, but like that's the picture I get in my head is the headspace or the calm, and you're focusing on your breathing. And I feel like there's different ways to practice that, just slowing down and being in the moment. Prayer, I think, is a form of, it could be classified as a form of meditation for me. So I've been looking for those places like on the edges for what I've previously thought of meditation as, where I could just practice the mindfulness. And I'm calling that meditation. And I'm saying that that is working for me. Do I sit on a cushion for 15 minutes a day? I do not. But when I feel myself starting to get stressed out, I notice it and I just stop and I close my eyes and I take some deep breaths. And so that's how I'm going to loosely define it. And I'm going to say that, yes, this is sticking for me. I know, have a long ways to go with this, but I feel like this has, even in the last couple of weeks, once I had that revelation and I just started looking for those itty bitty moments to start practicing this regularly, that has helped me stay more even keeled, more centered, I guess would be another word. You know, not the highs aren't as high, the lows aren't as low, a little bit less extreme.
That sounds very interesting. And I think you're right. We're going to cover a lot about mindfulness in today's book. Probably, like, if you want to make the differentiation between mindfulness and meditation and calling those two different things, we should probably do that, because I feel like today's book is going to go down the former and not the latter side of it. But we'll get into that, I think. So more to come on meditation is what I'm hearing.
Probably. I'm realizing some of the value of it, and like anything that I do, I probably am not going to be satisfied with just doing it a little bit, and I'm going to crank it up to 11.
Sure.
But I got to figure out how to do that for me, since all the traditional ways to do it haven't worked in the past.
Yep. We'll see if today helps with that. So I have three follow-up pieces. Number one was go through it all again, meaning go through the entire book again, not read it again, but some are like go through each of the questions. Actually, what I ended up doing was going through and copying each of the questions into my note for the book, like my book notes. And once I did that, I started taking each of those questions and putting them at different check-in points, because I've got some check-ins at like monthly, weekly, and daily, where I'm like setting up what projects am I going to tackle this week or this month, possibly even this quarter in the future. And that is something that has, it's been setting up really well to have these questions written down, because then I can put them in different check-in points. Not all of them. I didn't use all of these questions because that would be a lot. But the ones that I felt like were appropriate, I did put into those different places and have been using that for the last 4 weeks now, simply because, you know, we skipped a recording. And I think that has been super helpful. And the times that I've gone through it, it's been encouraging. So the whole answering questions thing is starting to wear off on me, Mike. So there's that. And one of the things that has come out of that is I ask a bank of these questions every morning as kind of a morning check-in. That was another follow-up here, is to do a morning and evening check-in journaling process. And one of the pieces that I ended up doing haphazardly was my third follow-up. So I had go through it all again, do a morning and evening check-in, and then do a visualize my day ahead of time. And what I didn't plan on was having the questions that I found from going through it all again that I had set up in my morning check-in to actually create the process of visualizing my day ahead of time. So it just kind of happened that way. I didn't intend that. It just kind of worked out. And I will say, like, that has helped me significantly in just knowing what's coming up today and getting my head around it. So far it's been going well, and I'm grateful for having gone through personal Socrates now, because now I am better at asking questions. So there's that.
All right. Yeah. This book is amazing. And I gifted a copy to a bunch of the people in my mastermind group. Several of them have read it already, but I feel like this is one of those books that just needs to be in your collection. Not to repeat the last episode, both rated it 5.0, but I've been seeing stuff all over Twitter, people that I'm following just talking about it. Jeff Goins mentioned it. A lot of people just really commenting about the design of the book, but even beyond the design, those questions, man, so good.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to make it my mission to get that book in the hands of as many people as humanly possible.
It's quite an undertaking.
It is.
Well, we should jump into today's book, because I feel like we're both kind of alluding to it a little bit. But today's book is Unwinding Anxiety by Judson Brewer, MD, PhD. And this is about the process and the patterns behind anxiety. And there's a lot to that. And yet I feel like it's very simple at the same time. But I picked this because my sense is that a lot of people that I talk to, whether that's at church or whether that's at like some of the funeral stuff that happens and such, it just seems like small groups. It seems like whenever I'm talking to people, a lot of folks tend to refer to being anxious about something, or there's something they're worried about or nervous about. I feel like that comes up a lot. And I don't feel like that's an accident. Now, obviously COVID, and I know that that has created a lot of anxiety, political unrest, and our widening chasm between parties doesn't help. Like, none of that is a helpful thing in this regard. But at the same time, like, that also means that anxiety levels have gone up as a society. The question is, what do you do about that? What can you do about it? And that's mostly what I was shooting for, is like, okay, I know that I deal with this somewhat. I have one friend who tells me he doesn't understand people who are anxiety stricken because he doesn't feel it at all. Like, that's interesting. You're the first person I've ever heard say that. So
yeah.
Okay. Can we like swap brains? So very jealous of him in that sense, but I feel like this is something that affects everybody in some form, whether it's directly or indirectly. So I feel like it could be a helpful one to work through, thus picking it.
Yeah. I was really nervous about this one when you picked it, to be honest, because
did it give you anxiety?
Maybe.
Sorry.
We're defining anxiety as a feeling of worry, nervousness, or unease, typically about an imminent event or something with an uncertain outcome, then yes. But I was concerned that this book was going to be very much like sitting on a psychiatrist's couch and how do you feel about that, which I don't really have a whole lot of interest in unpacking all of the negative feelings, what comes to mind is The Extended Mind by Annie Murphy Paul, and the whole idea of cognitive reappraisal and how like something happens and we assume that we have a feeling as an immediate response, but actually we can interpret the like physiological changes and reframe them. So when you get nervous about having to speak at an event or something, you can reframe that as excitement because it's the same changes, like your heart rate picks up, your blood pressure goes up a little bit, maybe, you know, like that fight versus flight response, and how you can actually choose to lean into some of the things instead of naturally avoiding them, which again, he's going to talk about in this book. And that's very different than just understand your feelings, man. Not that there's no value in that, but I feel like if that's the approach that we took in the current state of the world, we would find lots and lots of reasons to feel bad and feel like there's no way out of it. And so the extended mind approach, where we can change things, not necessarily even change the events that are happening, but how we're interpreting the events that are happening, allows us to move forward in a more positive and helpful direction. So I thought, just based on the title, the PhD in the author's name, that we were going to get the former, and I'm glad we got more of the latter.
I was very hesitant in picking it. I felt like I wanted the topic, but I wasn't really finding a book that was more highly recommended than this one in this area. But I had the same hesitation with like the whole, oh no, here we go, another doctor book. Like that was kind of my gut reaction. And yet, I'm grateful that, yes, there's a lot of science in this, maybe a hair too much, but he does break it down quite a bit so that it's a lot more approachable. So I'm grateful for that. So anyway, that said, let's jump into this. This is actually a 4-part book, even though he wanted it to be a 3-part book, because with a 4-part book, he starts it with part 0. So then he goes part 1, 2, 3 after that. But part 0... he wants to help you understand your mind and understand anxiety itself before he starts working through the process of how to unwind that. And I've got a couple points here. I kind of did the outline a little different this time, Mike. But this first one is understanding your mind. And he works towards defining anxiety, which you read off here a little bit earlier. But one of the things that's underneath that definition is fear as a base behind it. And when you stop and work through, like, okay, how did I get into this anxiety loop? How did I get into this worry pattern? And why am I always so stressed out? Like, ultimately, if you start breaking down how and why you got there, fear is at the bottom of it. Like, you're afraid of losing your job. You're afraid of the other team winning. You're afraid of the reaction you're going to get from your parents. Like, in some sense, there's fear behind that. And that's ultimately what like starts the process. And I say start the process because there's like I think I've alluded to it a few times now, like this whole loop and pattern that anxiety tends to follow. But before I get to that, Mike, thoughts on fear is the bottom?
Yeah, the reason that fear is the bottom is because in the prefrontal cortex, the logical part of your brain, it tries to predict what's going to happen. And then he mentions that anxiety enters and we don't have enough information to accurately predict the future. But I would argue that I don't even think it's not enough information for some types of brains like mine. There's always going to be more information to collect. And so there is no point in my brain where, okay, I have enough information now to accurately predict what's going to happen. I'm always going to feel at some level a little bit of that fear or anxiety just because I don't have it all. I mean, one example of this is anytime I'm going to make a major purchase on something, I need to over-research it. And I mean, over research it. Like, I had this moment yesterday when my wife and I were in Costco and they've got all the TVs there. the TV we have is like 15, 20 years old. We've got all this stuff in our house that supports 4K, but it's a 1080p TV. And so I'm like, wow, there's a 4K TV for $300. That looks pretty nice. And then I'm like, well, what's the difference between this one and that one over there? And oh, this one's OLED. And why is that better? And I realized at that moment that I was not going to walk out of there with a cheap 4K TV.
No.
I was going to go home and research this until I found the very best one. And I don't think it's going to add anything to my happiness. Had I just bought the $300 TV and brought it home, I would have been like, this thing is great. We've got 4K now. This is awesome. But it's almost like once I know what I'm missing, I can't be satisfied with that other option.
Unless it's the best, yes.
So this is a perpetuating cycle for me, and I need to fight against it. But yeah, so basically coming back to the intro here and why fear is the base, it's for most people anyways, it's because we don't have enough information. My brain just is never going to have enough.
I think you're spot on, because whether or not you're worried about the reaction of somebody else, or your fear is that something will be better and you will have made a bad decision, which I feel like is what you're saying. Like I've got a friend right now that they just, you know, they just bought a house, and it's taken them a very long time to find and purchase said house. And it's difficult, because whenever I first saw them, it's like, hey, congrats, heard you, you know, found a place. I'm like, yeah, but now the what if game starts. I'm like, what do you mean what if game? I'm like, well, what if something better comes up and we've already committed to this one? Like, so now like the anxiety of we can't find a house turns into anxiety of, is this one actually good enough? Just at some point you have to stop and be content with what you've decided on. But that's tough, because like I was saying, like anxiety, he calls out, is a habit loop where, and we'll talk about like how this works in the next part, but like it is a pattern. Like you have anxiety about something, and then some people choose to do something that's not helpful to the anxiety. Like if you take procrastination, a lot of times people who struggle with procrastination realize that they're super worried because they're not getting things done. But instead of working on those things, they do something to pacify, to like numb that worry by watching YouTube or scrolling Instagram. And it doesn't actually solve the problem, but it feels better than the problem of not being caught up. And then you feel bad about yourself. And then when you feel bad about yourself, you start to worry about all the stuff you haven't gotten done, which then leads you to scrolling YouTube because it feels better. And you get what I'm saying? Like it leads to this loop and ends up being a habit just in that, because of the repetitiveness of it. So I've never thought about it this way, Mike. Like I'm familiar with like anxiety and anxiousness and worry and stuff. Like I've been aware of that for quite some time, but I've never heard anybody call it a habit. And for as much as you and I have studied habits, that part caught me off guard. And I'm curious, did that catch you off guard? Or was it something, you know, with all your emotional intelligence background, this was very obvious to you?
Maybe it should have been obvious, but it wasn't.
Sure.
Like I see how it does reinforce that habit loop. The depressing part here at the beginning is that, going back to the topic of fear, that coupled with uncertainty is the formula for anxiety. Fear plus uncertainty equals anxiety, he says. And that's depressing, because there's always going to be uncertainty. And I feel like the further we go, the more uncertainty there is. Whether it's, did I make the wrong decision and you're constantly looking back, or you're scared to take a step until you have enough information like me, that feels like, well, what in the world can I do about this? Because fear is another constant. You're always going to be afraid of stuff. You don't have to let it paralyze you. But when I think about those two building blocks and how those are prevalent in my life, it's kind of like, you mean I'm going to have to be dealing with this junk forever?
Right.
And that's kind of frustrating. Maybe the habit stuff is kind of a a way he's trying to frame out of it. Like, you can change your habits, so you can actually change how you deal with anxiety. It doesn't have to be that bad. But this part of the book I didn't feel was, it should have been like super strong. Like, this is the foundation. But the habit loop stuff just kind of feels tacked on to me, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I understand he's going to talk about habits going forward, but I don't think that's the strength of this book. Let James Clear talk about
right
habits. You talk about mindfulness.
Right. Yeah. This is where, and let's move on to part one. But at the end of part zero, he starts to tell this story about the different gears of a bike and how, as you shift up gears, you can move faster and make better progress. And so he uses that analogy in the rest of the book. So he's got first gear, second gear, third gear, and you're working your way through those gears as you progress in different methods and different levels of working your way against anxiety. But at the first portion of part one, mapping your mind first gear, he explains this whole habit structure of trigger, behavior, result. Like, he uses that that terminology. And I think that's what he's alluding to at the end of part zero, because he's talking about anxiety is a habit loop. Well, those are the three components, if you follow history, of the what is a habit, right? Now, there's some questionable points. I think you would say there's four parts to that, if I recall your history, because there's like a whole awareness part that has to happen in there, right? But he sticks with these three. I think what he's referring to is that when he says that anxiety is a habit loop, I think all he's talking about is those three parts of a habit. And I think you're right. Like, it's hard to figure out if he's referring to like anxiety breeds itself and makes itself worse at all times and you can never get out of it, or if he's referring to anxiety has these three components to it that lead you to the anxious thoughts. And I never did connect which of those that he was trying to get at, because he did go straight into this trigger behavior result process of showing, kind of like what I was talking about earlier, like the procrastination piece of, I feel really behind, I feel nervous about that, and then that leads me to eating cake, and now I have a problem eating cake and I'm overweight, and now I don't feel well, I don't like myself, like all this stuff. Like, you start to go down this pattern, right? So mm-hmm. I feel like that's what he's referring to when he talks about habits, but anxiety as a loop is the part that I think breaks down.
Yeah, he builds a large portion of this book on the Charles Duhigg model, which I personally feel is a little bit of a mistake. I understand why he did it. I'm kind of curious how other people feel about like those three components versus James Clear's model, which introduces the fourth one, which that instantly clicked for me, because basically there's a temptation to do something, but that doesn't mean you have to automatically follow through and do it. And he's just building it on the three. And that temptation piece seems like the one that you should incorporate into dealing with anxiety.
Right.
Your body is telling you to feel this way, push against it and act a different way instead. And I feel like he gets into that kind of in the later parts of the book, but yeah, this just didn't really work for me, this whole foundation on the habit loop and the three pieces.
Yeah, I think there is, and when you say that he builds a large part of this book, I would almost argue that he builds the entirety of the book on that. And that is like the foundation that he uses to show how to beat anxiety. And he kind of beats it and beats it and beats it, so it gets kind of obnoxious after a while. But that said, I feel like we're going to come back to this one quite a few times, but he refers to the trigger behavior results. But then he also talks about like some of the things that we try to do that don't work. And this part, I think I resonated with him quite a bit on, because he talks about some of the problems with willpower, the problems with using substitution. Like, people talk about, you have your trigger, change the behavior to get a different result. Like, that's the substitution piece. Willpower, just when you say, I'm not going to do that, that doesn't work, right? So he at least goes through the process of debunking those. That part I'm with him on. Like, I feel like those both have their flaws. And it is something that I know that, like, at least for me, if I'm considering anxiety, a habit, and like some of these bad behaviors are habits, like that is something that I could easily see myself trying to do. It's like, oh, well, they say to just use, you know, a different behavior whenever certain things pop up. Maybe I'll just try that. Well, I've done that sort of thing in the past and works for about 2 hours and then goodbye. That's gone.
Yeah. The thing about this whole section, the anti-habit strategies that don't work, and then kind of what he proposes in as an alternative is simply the awareness of what's going on so you can take a different direction. I really like that. I feel like the anti-habit strategies, he defines these really well and how they all rely on a new brain, he calls it, but the old brain will take over at any given point. So that's the one we really gotta work on. And there's a single phrase in this chapter 6, which I think is kind of brilliant. Don't just do something, sit there. And I know he's not the first one to say that. I forget who he credits with that. But I feel like if there was one piece of advice in this whole section for me, that would be it. Because I tend to want to just jump in and take action. And that's good in some situations. But when you're trying to deconstruct why you feel anxious, it's not. You want to be able to have a little bit of time between the impulse and the response so you can figure out what's really going on and act accordingly.
Yeah, that whole, you know, just sit there concept. I feel like we've talked about this before, but it's something I'm realizing I do a lot. And it drives people crazy because whenever something breaks, either there's one of two courses that I follow. The first of which is I have a really good guess at what's wrong and I immediately go work on fixing it. If somebody were to say that my car was running and it just died all of a sudden, mechanics know that some of the first things you're checking are battery connections, you're checking alternators. Like these are some things that you're going to check because it very likely just lost power. Like, it's very simple. That's generally where people are going to start. However, if someone brings me something and I don't have that immediate, here's what I think is wrong moment, usually I sit and stare for a second, if not longer than a second, which gets uncomfortable for the other person, but I'm okay with that. And I'm just kind of processing, like, okay, what are the options? You know, the whole Occam's razor concept, the simplest solution is the most likely. That's mm-hmm. what I'm trying to process of what are the simplest potential solutions and start there. And that whole thing is super powerful. Like just stop and reflect on what is happening. And that brings us to like he's kind of wrapping up this first part of mapping your mind. Like he brings that to the introduction of mindfulness. And that's where he spends the bulk of the book talking about what to do with this. Most of it is taking the time to just notice what is happening and become aware of when you go into these patterns. Like if you follow this trigger behavior result habit process, how do you identify those points? Now, we could probably argue the whole temptation piece that you're talking about with Clear and probably could alter a lot of his book to include that, to be honest.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think that the idea of pay attention to what is going on with your brain and what is leading you down that path is the part that can help you break the pattern, if you're with me.
Yep, agreed. And this is also where he gets into the fight versus flight, and he introduces a third one, which is freeze. And again, he's probably not the originator of that. I forget where it really comes from. That idea we've talked about before, but I like the framing of these behavioral tendencies he talks about. And he's got a quiz, assessment, whatever, survey thing. Did you take that?
No, but I didn't take it, but I figured out what his scoring method was and just kind of walked my way through it and kind of made some guesses like, oh, well, that's me. Like I got there very quickly. I didn't need to do it formally.
I took it formally and scored 13 towards avoid, which I believe is like the 90th percentile on that end of the spectrum. So what that means is that when I feel anxious, my tendency is to avoid. I'm the flight. I run away. So that doesn't have to be, though, fighting for survival. If you think about this in the context of the world we live in right now, what that really means is that when there's any sort of like conflict or uneasiness, instead of leaning into it, I tend to go away from it. And just recognizing that is a good thing, because later in the book, he's going to talk about comfort zones and growth and all that kind of stuff. So already at this point in the book, even though I disagree with all of the foundational habit stuff and he's missing a piece, I feel like this is a big this is a big revelation for me, is that when I feel uncomfortable, that's actually probably an indication that I should lean into that thing, or at least that I should recognize that tendency and then ask myself why and kind of reset and re-engage. Like, okay, you're feeling this way, but that's not necessarily the right way. So let's look at this for what it is, gather more information. Again, the thing for me is I'll never have enough information. So
right.
I think I generally want to just recognize, okay, feeling like I should avoid, instead I'm going to approach, see what happens.
Right. Yeah, I know that, like, I didn't do the formal scoring, but I came out as avoid as well. Very, very strongly. I don't know what the numbers were because I didn't actually do it, but it's something that I know I do. Like, I've mentioned the procrastination thing, but you could also get into, like, there's a task that I love to do, but for some reason I'm not doing it. Why? Like, I run into that one a lot. It's like, okay, well, now I'm procrastinating on something that I like to do. Why? That seems strange. So just kind of leaning into, like, okay, pay attention to what's happening and why am I feeling that resistance? And here's what happened. I have time to do the thing I want to do, but I'm not doing it. I did what instead? Use the YouTube examples. Like, I spent time on YouTube and then I felt what? Which actually brings us to part two. I feel like I'm moving through this quickly. But the part two here is updating your brain's reward value. Second gear. So he's stepping it up. It's like, okay, you've got the first piece of just being aware of what's happening. But once you become aware of it, that starts to help you get into second gear, which helps you get into this disenchantment part, which he calls out here, which if you take that loop, right? So you've got your trigger behavior result. If you become aware of what it is that's leading you to feel the anxiety and what it is that's giving you the worry, you notice what your trigger is. Like, I don't want to do the thing. And instead of doing the thing, I spend time on Instagram. And then afterwards, I feel icky. Or like the example that he calls out is somebody who was in smoking. And he taught her this loop process. Like, okay, well, you have the craving for a cigarette. You smoke the cigarette. How do you feel afterwards? Pay attention to how you feel afterwards. And she noticed that it tastes gross and smelled bad. So, like, just because of that, then she connected that every time she went to smoke, she was about to do something gross and something that smelled bad. And she couldn't get that out of her head, and it helped her break the habit. That process is what he's getting at. It's like learning what the negative feelings are from going through that loop. That's what he's encouraging you to do.
How effective do you see that being in everyday life, though? I'm a little bit skeptical of this, to be honest. I understand what he's saying. He talks about in chapter 10 how that reward value is mapped to the orbital frontal cortex, the OFC. So he's got all the scientific terms to support what he's saying here. And he wants us to recognize, like, specifically with a habit we want to break, look at what we actually get from the activity. But for somebody who, the average person, let's say, who has developed an addiction over many years, I find it hard to believe that simply being aware of, oh, this is bad for me and I should stop, is enough to get them to do so.
I think this is bogus. Okay. Just to be completely upfront with you, this is why when I finished that, I said this is what he's calling you to do. Because I don't see this actually working, at least this particular part of it, because if you're mindful of what's happening, so just take this, like, you have a bad habit, whatever it is, and you start to pay attention to what it is you're doing and how you feel about it. And that's great. Like, you can learn a lot about your bad habits doing that, but noticing that they have bad feelings and bad effects, somebody who struggles with alcohol abuse, they know that it's bad. People who smoke cigarettes generally know it's bad for them, and yet they continue doing it. So, like, just that whole piece, it doesn't add up. It just doesn't. Like, I feel like he's missing something with that, or at least he's trying to set up something that doesn't connect. Like, I get what he's trying to say in that, like, learning that the physical thing that you're doing, whether it's smoking or, you know, something simple like avoiding somebody, if you're avoiding somebody or have these bad habits, like, just learning that there's a bad feeling involved, I feel like is not going to be anywhere near the motivation you need to break the loop. That doesn't add up to me at all.
I think it could. I don't think it will in even the majority of people, but that's just me being skeptical and having no data to support that claim.
Right.
He does call out that simply mapping out habit loops and seeing their lack of value does not magically unwind years of entrenchment, but I feel like out of the other side of his mouth, he's basically saying at some point it will.
Right.
There's some good stuff in here. He talks about how old habits are outdated, but because they're old, they're familiar, and because they're familiar, we trust them. So this is all true information, and it could theoretically be helpful, but I just have a hard time envisioning going through this and having that aha moment, like, oh, I never realized this was the thing that was happening, and now that I realize that, like you said, that this activity is bad for me, and afterwards I feel bad that I did it, now I can start not doing it. I feel like that's probably a step on the journey, but it feels like there's a lot missing from this section. It feels a little fantastic to me, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
Right.
A lot of the productivity books, and this is, I would argue, not one of the productivity books that we read, but like, just follow these three simple steps and you'll save an hour a day every day for the rest of your life. That's kind of what this feels like for anxiety and habit loops. And with habit loops specifically, I know it's not that simple.
Right.
And maybe that's the issue here, is because it's framed on the cue routine reward, or TBR, trigger behavior reward. But he doesn't get into all the other stuff that we know is true about habits. It feels a little bit like, just take my word for this and then just do this thing. But we're skeptical because we know there's a whole lot more to it, having gone through both atomic habits and also, I would argue, tiny habits, which that trigger behavior reward is really based off of.
Yeah, I know that this is definitely a piece of the whole process, because, like, if you look at his different gears, like, he wants you to get to third gear so that you can break the loops. But part one, he's talking about mindfulness, like, he's introducing you to becoming aware of these things. Two, he's like showing you some of the things you're going to find, like this disenchantment piece. Another one is learning from the past, like the reflective piece of just paying attention to what happens after something happens. Like, if you avoid the gym one day, it makes it easier to avoid it the next day. Like, that concept of learning from your past behaviors. The thing that's interesting to me is that it's something that, like, these are all steps in the process, but yet he doesn't get to the very end until, of course, part three. But inside that process, it seems like it's dependent on the next one, but he calls it out as if it's something that could break things in itself. Like, I get the idea that, like, doing mindfulness and then learning the disenchantment thing, like, those are pieces that can help you break it in themselves, but it seems like it's dependent on the next ones sometimes. Like, it's not a, this is the process, which is what I feel like he's initially saying, like, this is the answer, and yet it's not. So, I don't know, he's hard to follow.
So, if I were to rewrite this section for him as a non-doctor, I would say, do what he's talking about. Ask yourself, what did I actually get out of these activities? But I would immediately follow that up with, record it all in a journal and write in it every day and reflect on the day at the end of the day. And I feel like that's maybe the missing piece. And I guess I'm kind of curious, if what do you think, if you just developed a journaling habit, do you feel like some of these insights would surface automatically? I kind of think they would.
Yeah, I think so. Just having started like this whole morning and evening ritual of journaling and stuff, and some of the questions I'm asking being very like, are you being honest with yourself? Like some of those questions are ones I'm asking. Like that is something I find is surfacing some of the anxiety issues, and just that reflective process is all it takes. Like just being aware of like, am I lying to myself? Well, yeah, in some ways I'm convincing myself that something is not easily done when it is. Like it's going to take me 2 minutes, but I'm avoiding it because I think it's going to be some big hairy thing. So I'm lying to myself. Yeah. Just asking myself that question is all it took to get there. I don't need to go through this whole process here, but
right.
I don't know.
Agreed.
Not a doctor on it.
Not a doctor.
So I guess that brings us to part three here. And this is where we're supposed to button the whole process up, right? So you've learned mindfulness. We've learned to learn from the past and be disenchanted with the negatives. And then we get to part three, which is finding that bigger, better offer for your brain, or third gear. And by the bigger, better offer, pretty much what he's telling us to do is to substitute, which is the thing he told us to watch out for. And I struggled with this because it's like basically what we're being told, this is my interpretation of it, so correct me if I got this wrong, Mike, but the way I took it was whenever you're sensing that you've got this negative habit that's leading to anxiety, you need to learn to notice it, notice the negative effects of it, and then find a better thing to do instead of that. At least that's the way I took it, which to me is like the definition of the substitution thing he told us not to do. So I got real confused when we got to this point. So hopefully you can square me away here.
Yeah, so the actual definition for substitution, or what he says about it, is that like willpower, it relies on the new brain, may work for a subset of people, but doesn't uproot the craving itself. And that's kind of how it's framed in part three as well. To create a new habit, you update the value of the old one, you present a better offer without feeding the habit loop through mere substitution, is the last piece there. So I think it's not, what he's saying is more nuanced and more accurate, I think, than substitution, but on the surface, it kind of appears the same. So when you update the value of the old one, really what he's hoping that does is causes you to realize there isn't any value in the activity that you're doing, and that's enough motivation to give up smoking, like the lady that he shared in the book. Then you present something else, and then that translates into motivation to do a new desired action. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about this. I understand the motivation is very powerful, and if you can hack your motivation that way, that's probably the ideal way to do it. But I also think of, and some of these people, like, they're too extreme. I know we both really liked Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink. The more I know about that guy, though, the less I like him. Not the less I like him, just that he's not for me, you know? He's posting pictures and videos of himself getting up at 4:30 every morning, and that's just too extreme.
He's one of these super high energy Grant Cardone, Gary Vee sort of types.
Yes, exactly. But I do think there's some truth to his whole message, which is like, you don't feel like it? Tough, do it anyways. You can accomplish a lot of good in your life by just doing the things you don't want to do. You don't have to rely solely on the motivation, which maybe that comes back again to the fact that there's that missing fourth leg to the stool when it comes to habits. So I understand what he's doing here. It sounds nice. I do think that it's not structurally sound, though, because it's still built on the habit stuff. Now, that being said, there's a lot of cool stuff in this section that I really liked. So I don't want to bash on this too much. I think he gets into like curiosity, and that's fascinating to me, the two different kinds of curiosity, interest versus deprivation. And that's my one action item from this whole book, to be honest, is to practice curiosity. And he uses it. He uses the example of people just saying, hmm. So that's my action item. I want to, whenever I feel frustrated by a situation, just be like, hmm, and see what options that opens up in my brain.
Right. That is exactly my one and only action item from this book as well. So great minds, Mike. And like the curiosity piece, like that, I wish that was like his core foundation of the book, because I feel like that is the point at which the rest of it is encompassed inside of that. So take what he's saying so far. Mindfulness, pay attention to what's going on. Be curious about what's going on. Ask the questions about how you feel about it. What's happened in the past? How is this affecting you? Is it true? Is it not? Like, these are the questions that are all kind of wrapped up in this whole curiosity concept. And if you want to take like the bigger, better offer, whether I've got it right or you've got it right, I don't know. But trying to figure out, well, if I substitute something in this case, will it work? Like whenever I know, like, for example, I know that I tend to be very tired in the afternoons and it's hard for me to do like heavy brain work. So I know that in the afternoon, if I want to avoid the temptation of losing time to YouTube and such, that I have to set up things for me to do physically in the afternoon. So like this afternoon, I'm tearing apart some shelves behind me here. So like, I know that because in the afternoons, like I'm not going to be able to spend time writing out my thoughts and deciding things and writing emails. Like I cannot do it. Like my brain is just shot by that point. So I cannot pull that one off. So setting those up and being aware of that is only like in my case, like it's only really been done because I've been curious about why am I not able to get anything done in the afternoons? Why do I always get tired before I get there? And what happens when I get tired? Now, he would probably say, well, you're just paying attention to that trigger behavior reward result process. But I feel like a lot of it just has to do with wondering why things are happening. And so all this to say, like, I feel like the curiosity piece is the crux of a lot of this. And I wish it had come up earlier.
The why is interesting because in chapter 20, he asked the question, what if the why doesn't matter? And that's an interesting thought experiment.
Yeah.
As someone whose life is basically trying to figure out why, he's basically encouraging us, don't stress out trying to figure it out. And I feel like that's good advice and is not contradictory to the curiosity that he talks about. Because when you approach something with curiosity, you're not approaching it like a problem that needs to be solved. You're just trying to see it and understand it a little bit better and understand what is really going on. And he has this phrase that curiosity pulls, but willpower pushes. And I feel like that's a very good explanation. Now, how does that fit into all of this stuff with anxiety? I don't know exactly. I do like this rain thing that he talks about, how not to freak out when anxiety hits. Number one, you recognize or you relax into what is arising. Number two, you accept or allow it to be there. Number three, you investigate the bodily sensations, emotions, and thoughts. And then number four, you note what is happening from moment to moment. So I feel like this is the book encapsulated, and I'm so glad that we went through how to read a book all those years ago at this point, and the whole idea of like the syntopical reading and fitting this in with the other books.
Yeah.
Because basically what this is saying is take the extended mind approach of cognitive reappraisal, but journal about it.
Right.
Write it down.
Yep.
And then as you do that, you'll start to see things more clearly and respond less emotionally.
Yes. Yeah, you mentioned like the why doesn't matter. That he refers to it as the why habit loop. Not worrying about the why behind it, because like sometimes people are like, well, I'm not fixing this thing. Why is that? Well, you know, I'm still anxious. Well, don't worry about why. It doesn't matter why. Like, continue to search for the things that are leading you down that anxious path, which is the curiosity piece. So don't necessarily worry about why you know results. Focus on the curious of why are you still doing these certain patterns. So you have to be careful with that sort of thing. But
you do.
I feel like this is the part that like encompasses everything in the book. And I feel like this is like the wrap up point here. But it's an interesting overall process that I think he's worked through. And I feel like it's kind of misfired in a number of places. And I got, maybe this is me, but I feel like I got confused a lot of like, what are we talking about? And why are we talking about this particular thing again? I got super lost many, many times. And I have my thoughts for why that is, but I'll save that at this point.
That's interesting. I agree with you, but again, we'll do that when we get to style and rating. I'm curious, what is, if you or I were to write a book, what is the better approach? Because it seems to me the issues that I have with this are the fact that he's trying to make it all encompassing, everything you need to know, all the science behind it, instead of saying, hey, there's other people who have studied habits and go see what they have to say. But the big takeaway here is this, you know, he gets into all the details, and that's where I focused on. And I probably at that point am not seeing the forest through the trees because he's saying specific things that I'm disagreeing with. And I recognize that. Maybe I just missed his point with this. So assuming you're going to write a book on whatever topic, do you try to give the reader everything they need to know in order for this topic to make complete sense? Or do you just say, this is built on some other stuff that some other people have written, so go read this stuff? I feel like that's hard to know where to draw that line. And I can totally see where a publisher or an editor would be like, hey, you didn't explain this enough.
Yep.
You got to go into like why habits work. But for people like you and me, that was detrimental.
Yeah, I think this is a good point to bring up, Mike, because this is something I feel like we deal with a lot on Bookworm. We talk about this a lot. Like, you shouldn't have tried to explain this. There are people who did it better. My sense is that, and I don't know when this started, how recent this is, but if you go back to how to read a book that we covered and didn't care for and yet reference constantly, that book talks about how a great way to find your next books to read are to pull the references out of the one you're in right now, right? So take the references in the current book you're reading and use that as a jumping off point for where to go next. Off the top of your head, Mike, how many book references did he mention in this book?
Ooh, I can't think of any. I know he talked about the habit stuff, and I know, well, I shouldn't say I know. I think he talked about Charles Duhigg's The Power of Habit when he introduced that, but I can't think of any others.
I don't think he actually mentioned Charles Duhigg when he got to that point. The only one I can think of is he mentioned Carol Dweck and Growth Mindset.
Okay.
The mindset book, yeah. So I know that he mentioned that. But again, in How to Read a Book, what he's referring to is the long list of references that people generally have in a book. So what I'm getting at is that so many times we read these books and it's like, there's people who did better than that. They should reference those. Summarize it for me in like a paragraph, the part that applies to what you're talking about. Reference the book. You don't have to tell me to go read it, because if I'm interested in that topic, I'll go read it. Pull out the part that applies to what you're talking about, reference the book, and move on. So many of our authors today, I feel like they want to be the single point of truth for everything. And I don't want you to do that, because the whole point is you're adding your thoughts to the broader collective of knowledge. You're not the one and only place I'm going to go to learn about anxiety and habits. I'm going to apply that to how many other people. But I also know that some of this is just because you and I are oddballs when it comes to this, because of the syntopical reading patterns that we tend to apply because of How to Read a Book. And as a result of that, we're putting together a very big picture that I don't know if I say most, but a lot of people don't do that. So it gets to be kind of messy. But because people don't reference other books anymore, I shouldn't say anymore, because they just don't do it as much. But if you go back to, like, take Personal Socrates. If you read through that book, there's reference after reference after reference after reference in that book. There's tons of books that are referenced in that one. Ryan Holiday's books are the same way. There are tons of references to other books. If you go back and look at a lot of our 5-star books, I bet you would find tons of references inside those books. And now, I don't know if that's a key indicator for Bookworm ratings or not, but I feel like that's something that's very important, because it's taking the knowledge that I'm writing into my book and incorporating it into this broader knowledge of books. But when you have somebody who does like what Brewer did here, it gets tricky, because I feel like he's not doing that. He's like trying to make it its own thing and not use that knowledge of all these other people before him. I don't know.
Yeah, I could see that. He does base a lot of this off of experience, people that he's worked with. He's got one guy, Dave, that he tells his story in four different parts.
Yeah.
Which I didn't really care for. It's an interesting point. I think you're right. That is probably part of my issue with this. And again, that's not to say that there's not good stuff in here, but it just does feel a little bit weird. Like, trust me, I've gone up the mountain. I have the stone tablets. This is the truth.
Right.
And that's very anti how to read a book, where we're having a conversation or even a debate and we're asking the questions and we're arguing with the author. There really isn't a whole lot of room to argue here and still reconcile these things in your head. I think that's where I got
right.
off.
Right.
There are a couple other things in this last section, though, I did like and I want to touch on. He's got some cool visuals. He's got one about, in Dave's story, part three, the comfort zone in the middle, and then the growth zone, which is outside of that, and then outside of that is the panic right. zone. And I don't know if this speaks to everybody. Maybe if you are the other end of the spectrum when you take that quiz, this speaks to you differently, but for me, I tend to stay in the comfort zone. So being someone who naturally avoids things, when I say I want to start to lean into things, what that does, if you look at this like bullseye style target, is it forces me outside of the comfort zone into the growth zone. And the big thing he's saying here, the big takeaway, is that the world outside our comfort zone is not always dangerous, which... he's definitely understanding me when he says that. The other thing is that in chapter 22, he talks about how he did a personal retreat when he wrote this book. So obviously I'm a big fan of that.
Convinced his wife to go away so he could write it. Yep.
Whatever you got to do.
What else, Mike? You want to jump into action items?
Let's do it.
So I have the one, which is to be curious, super curious. Like, I just want to, like, be aware. Like, try to do the whole curiosity thing. Because I feel like that's a lot of the crux that should be applied here. So, like, that's really it. Like, I want to spend some time, you know, whenever I'm doing these journaling pieces. Like, I've got some questions that I haven't formalized, but I've started the process of, like, what should these be to help me try to understand what it is that I'm off base with. So, like, that's the whole curiosity piece I want to try to apply. What I got.
All right. Well, mine is similar, but it was specifically to implement the
Yeah.
I feel like that is the action that I could substitute when I see the trigger, right. even though it doesn't work according to him. But I feel like I can recognize now when I'm feeling a little bit stressed out. We didn't really talk a whole lot about the mindfulness versus meditation piece. But just real briefly, he talks about how meditation is actually a part of mindfulness. And he's got like the circle of meditation. It's inside a much bigger circle for mindfulness. And mindfulness is not about emptying. It's about changing our relationship with our thoughts. So recognizing that I'm thinking this certain way, not implementing what he calls shoulding, like I should be able to let this go, or I should be able to move on to the next thing. That's self-judgment cycle. And I definitely recognize that I have a tendency to slip into that as well. So just recognizing the feeling and then verbally going, because I feel the application of that physically is the thing that will bring value to me. It's not enough just to recognize it and tell my brain, stop doing that, go do this other thing. That physical action, that is the trigger, I think, for being more curious instead of more, I don't know, problem solving, you know? Not everything that happens, not everything that feels uncomfortable is a problem that I should solve. And so I want to insert that as like the pause between the impulse and the response.
I like it. It's a good one. So as for style and rating, I have lots and lots of thoughts on style, but suffice it to say, it's very disjointed, I found. There were many, many stories that were brought up. There were a lot of examples that I felt like didn't apply. I got lost as to what we were talking about regularly. And I feel like he didn't have real good ways of like buttoning up the whole thing. It just got to be super messy. And I really struggled with it. There was so many times that I was like, wait, what is this chapter about again? And why is this different than the others? Like, I feel like you just want to tell a story about some science you've done. Like, that was my perspective. And I don't know how much truth there is to that. Maybe I just got jaded at some point in the book and started to see it through that lens. That's very possible. Honestly, I feel like the thing that you should take away from this is, you know, be curious, do the thing. And I'm tempted to say, like, I don't want you to read this. Like, it's just kind of a mess. And I feel like it could cause more problems than good. So, yes, there are some good things in it, but I feel like we covered those. And I don't know how much I would have someone dive into this and how much you would get from it. I don't know. I struggled with this one. I thought this would be a lot tighter of a book and a lot more buttoned up, but here we are. So as for a rating, that makes it messy. So I think in my case, I'm going to put this at a 2.5. Like, this is way down there for me. And it's primarily because, like, I just wanted it to be in a line and it was all over the place. And there were a lot of things I'm like, wait, hold up. I don't think that's true. Like, yes, you've got all this science stuff that you're talking about, but you're not really showing me where all that comes from. Like, in the broader scheme of things, like, it's like this one single point that I feel like you're trying to force into it. So I don't know. If you read this one, be careful with it, but I'm going to put it at a 2.5. I don't think I want it higher than that.
All right. Interesting. Wasn't expecting a 2.5 from you.
I got frustrated pretty bad with this one.
I feel there is some really good stuff in here. And I do like the general flow of how it's outlined. The end of the book, chapter 23, is anxiety, sobriety. And it talks about how, like, Alcoholics Anonymous, part of the process is helping others, how being kind feels good and self-empowering, and you can become addicted to kindness, and like that's the path forward. I felt like that was a really powerful way to end the book, and I feel like there's some really great stuff in here. I do think that I had some trouble disconnecting from what I felt was a shaky foundation of the TBR, the trigger behavior result, and all the habit stuff at the beginning. But I also, reviewing my MindNode file before recording, recognized that there were several aha moments for me in this. Just the mindfulness and meditation piece alone. Again, that wasn't the only place that I heard that, but that was kind of like a missing puzzle piece in where I was with the previous action item about creating a meditation habit that actually sticks. So I felt like this was one of the things that kind of clicked into place and allowed me to feel like, okay, yeah, I can do this for the first time ever.
Yeah.
So I definitely got some value out of this. And I think it's easy to nitpick the stuff that didn't jive necessarily with us. And I'm trying to disconnect from that because I feel like some of that maybe is just personal opinion, and we tend to weigh it more heavy than maybe we should have. I'm going to rate it at 3.5. When you say you hesitate whether you would recommend this to people, I feel like I would recommend this to people, but I would also say that this isn't going to be the only thing you should read on this topic. Like, this is the beginning maybe of your journey, but you've got a lot more to go. And if you've already been reading along with us and you understand Atomic Habits and things like that, there probably are better books to build on that foundation going forward, but I don't know what they are. It was significantly better than I thought it was going to be. I told you I was very apprehensive about getting into this one because I didn't want to have a conversation with a psychologist via book form. And that's not what I got. I was pleasantly surprised by the content in this one, to be honest. And yeah, I can nitpick little things about it, but I feel like the main message is fairly solid. If I can stop focusing on the habit part for a second, and then just kind of flow with everything that he's telling me throughout the rest of the book, I feel like that maybe changes what you're able to get out of it. But again, like that is a skill that I did not have a couple of years ago.
Right.
I recognize now every single book that I go into that this is not going to be the be-all, end-all on whatever topic, even though every single author seems to want to position their book that way. I go into it thinking there's going to be something in here for me, and I'm going to jot down the things that I like, and the things that I don't, I'm going to discard. And in a podcast format, people like to hear us complain about stuff, so we'll focus on the habit stuff. But I feel like just in the content of the book that there's a lot of good stuff in here. So I would recommend this to people. I would say don't buy it hook, line, and sinker. Like question all of this stuff for yourself and figure out how it applies to you. But if you go into it curious, then I think you'll get something out of it. At least I got something out of it. So I have conflicting opinions walking out of this. Because on one hand, I'm like, there's got to be something better on this topic that I want to read. But on the other hand, I don't want to touch anything else in this genre.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this genre speaks to you, if you really like this topic and you want to dive into it, you know, go for it. But I was apprehensive to begin with and it was better than expected.
Yep. I hear you. All right. Let's put it on the shelf. Mike, what's up next?
Next is Creative Calling by Chase Jarvis, which is a big one. So if you haven't started it, do it now. It's like 280 pages or something. And it's basically about living a creative lifestyle. I've started this one, not very far in it, just kind of read like the introductory section. And I feel like this is going to be good because he's kind of calling out, doesn't matter if you're an artist, an entrepreneur, whatever, you have the ability to be creative, which is something that I have long believed. And I feel like this is one of those books that will empower you and hopefully give you some clear, you know, here's how you would actually start walking this stuff out. Time will tell on that part, I guess. But yeah, Creative Calling by Chase Jarvis is next. And then after we read that, what are we going through?
Yeah, so up next after that, I discovered a book called Yes to Life by none other than Viktor Frankl, which is a series of, I believe it's lectures that he gave after he wrote his other book, Man's Search for Meaning. And I was not aware that this existed. It was translated to English in 2020, I believe, and published. And when I saw that there was another book by Viktor Frankl that was post his other, like, yep, uh-huh, I want to read that. And I figured you wouldn't argue with me.
I will not. I will happily read this one. I will look forward to this one much more than I did Unwinding Anxiety.
There you go. So yeah, Yes to Life by Viktor Frankl. So with the extra blank in time, Mike, did you read a couple Gap books, one at all?
I read so many Gap books, it's ridiculous. I was on vacation, so... I'm going to pick one here, How to Fight a Hydra by Josh Kaufman. Have you read this?
No, I have it on my list, though.
You would love this. It's a short little book. It's tiny. It's probably about the size of, a little bit bigger than an iPhone, the size of the book. And it's maybe 90 pages. And it's an adaptation of a fable that he found in some old bookstore. It's like a 12th century Bulgarian fable or something that he modernized. And it's about this person who's seeking fame and fortune, and he's going to go kill a hydra, and he's going to get the treasure behind it. And there's a whole lot of lessons to be learned there, very a la Stephen Pressfield, I feel. So if you like Stephen Pressfield's style, minus the language wrapped in a fable, that's kind of what this is.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I feel like that's one I should definitely read.
Yeah, and you can read the whole thing in like an hour.
Yeah, so I have been going through a book called Shape Up. If you're familiar with this is from the Basecamp team. And this is primarily like shaping and positioning what they would call pitches. basically, how do you pitch an idea to your team and shape it in such a way that you can achieve it in a certain amount of time? And I've actually gone through it a couple times over the last couple weeks, just because like what I'm working through at work anyway is how do I shape some of the projects for the teams that I'm working with in order to have them achieve them successfully in the time frame we have to do it. So trying to figure out good ways to do that. We've been using Basecamp internally for that sort of thing, so I figured it made sense to try to follow some of their process as well. So that's an interesting one. I'm not sure how I would translate that to like personal life scenarios, though some people do it. But anyway, shape up.
I'm familiar with this book, and I want them to print the physical one so that I can buy
it.
I'm not reading a PDF. Yes. Sorry.
That was the hard part with it, is the whole PDF thing. That's kind of messy. Not fun to do it that way at all. So anyway, there's that. We are very grateful to those of you who have joined us live. I know Martin and Michael and a few others have jumped in today. So very big thank you to those of you who have done that. I know it was short notice that we recorded today because we're doing this one as kind of a fast turnaround given our gap last time around. But if you haven't already, another place that you can get connected to us is on the Bookworm Club. So club.bookworm.fm. And inside of that club, there is a way to join our membership. And you can get the shortcut to get there is bookworm.fm/membership. And when you do that, it's $5 a month. Helps us keep the lights on here, helps us buy our books. But you also get some cool perks with that. You get an awesome background that Mike put together. You get Mike's MindNode files and all the notes that he's taken on that as well. Some old Gap book episodes that I've recorded in the past. So there's just a lot of cool stuff going on there. And we'd love to have you join that. So again, that's bookworm.fm/membership.
All right. If you are reading along with us, pick up Creative Calling by Chase Jarvis, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.